Welcome to episode 428 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Tomek Kowalski. I've had the pleasure of meeting Tomek a couple of times in various triathlon-related contexts, so I know him a bit, and I know that he's a very, very smart guy, so I've been looking forward to having him on the podcast for quite some time, and I'm very pleased that we made it happen and how the interview turned out. We have two main topics that we discuss in this interview. Firstly, around training and racing for top age group athletes, so the type of athletes that are aiming to perform well, even podium and win at world championship events. This is something that Tomek has quite some experience with, so we discuss that. And then secondly, we discuss Tomek's research interest, which is primarily in respiratory muscle training in endurance sports. So not a topic that we've covered really at all, as far as I can remember, on this podcast, or not a lot anyway. So that was really exciting as well to get more insight into that particular topic. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They help athletes personalize their hydration and fueling strategies for training and racing. You can use their free fuel and hydration planner to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake in your next event. And if you want even more help, why not book a free 20-minute video consultation and to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of any of their carbohydrate or sodium products by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. You can target specific aspects of your stroke, like catch and your pull through. And the design of the bench forces you to constantly work on core activation, which can help your body position in the water. Most importantly, it allows you to stay consistent in your training even when you don't have time to go to the pool. You can try the Senate risk free for up to 30 days and you can get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Tomek Kowalski. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Tomek. How are you doing?
Hello, how are you? And thanks for having me here. I'm fine. Hope you are well as well.
Yeah, I'm good. Are you in Portugal at the moment on training camp?
Yeah. We are almost neighbors. I am staying in Monte Gordo, Algarve. It's southern part of the Portugal.
Excellent. Yeah, nice. Very nice place to train. For anybody that hasn't been, can recommend that. So let's start with an introduction. Tell us a bit more about yourself.
Okay, I'm a triathlon coach. I work as a triathlon coach and a researcher. I also work as a consultant in terms of endurance preparation for some different sport disciplines. I worked as a triathlon coach for over a decade. Myself, I competed in cycling and triathlon. I wasn't super good, but I also wasn't too bad. I won like the age group categories in multiple races. However, never got the pedigree to go race professionally. So I started coaching very early, and I was very lucky to work with the talented athletes early on. And I do it for over 10 years. Right now, I'm together with my wife, we are running a triathlon company called Trinergy, which is kind of pretty good. We had athletes winning the Ironman World Championship multiple times in a tri club Ironman World Championship. We also was ranked as a top club. We're doing pretty well. Apart from that, I work as a researcher for almost 2 years in Institute of Sport, which is like a national lab. Working with Olympic national teams in Polish sport. It's based in Warsaw, Poland. And on top of that, I also work with Paulo Sousa, helping him to run the triathlon squad.
Yeah, and that's how we first connected, just to give some context for the listeners. One thing that I think is quite interesting is how with the tri squad that you run, Trinergy, that you have been ranked as a top club. So on that, because it's a Polish club, right? And with only Polish athletes, Poland, of course, you have some great athletes, but it's not necessarily known as the country with the most triathletes. So can you talk a little bit more about triathlon in Poland? Is it getting more and more popular and you're getting really good athletes in the doors of the club? How have you managed to get the club up to such a high-performing level?
Well, definitely got more popular across the last 10 years. We're still not like a triathlon powerhouse. We didn't have any athletes racing at Olympic Games in Tokyo. Hopefully, we may have one woman in Paris. In the same time, it's more difficult to run a triathlon club now than it was like 10 years ago, because at that time, there were a lot of low-hanging fruits. If you just listen to the podcast, follow some international online boards, there were access to a lot of resources, and it wasn't just implemented in Poland. So it was very easy just to learn from the common sources and try to implement that in our environment. And it already was a competitive advantage. So for example, for me as a coach, during my first year of like full-time work, my athlete won a national championship, which is kind of a big deal for the coach that begins to work. And so, doing simple things right was enough at that time. But then it got harder and harder and harder. The competition got bigger. The international level got also higher. So it's way more popular now than it used to be. We have some interesting long course athletes, and I hope that we can just show ourselves more in the international area. But obviously, this international level is higher than it used to be a few years ago.
Yeah. So let's use that as a segue into a big coaching discussion. So maybe you can start with an overview of your, let's call it coaching methodology or general thoughts about coaching and training.
Well, it's a common question to discuss coaching philosophy. And unfortunately, I don't have a very interesting answer, because the only coaching philosophy I employ is to do as much of the things that work and as little of the things that don't work. So I'm not really personally attached to any big idea or any big school of thoughts or a concept, which has like some pluses and disadvantages. One of the pluses is that I have no problems in pivoting or changing. If I see something benefits my athletes more than the stuff I was doing in the past, I'm really happy to change that without much hesitation. On the other hand, obviously, a lot of coaches have this distinctive point or perspective that they promote, and I don't feel like being attached to this kind of narration. Obviously, I changed the stuff in my work a few times now, and every time I think it was a change for the better. However, I had to ditch some of the thoughts of the ideas I employed before. So I think I'm a very flexible coach. But overall, I think that individual approach is super important. I think having a good program, the program that you can like complete consistently for a long of time with a lot of patience is super important. I really focus on keeping my athletes healthy, both like in physically and in good well-being, being interested in sport. But yeah, there is no like one big thing like, you know, Norwegian school or French school, or I'm a big fan of, you know, I don't know, being a recovery coach. No, I just try to pick what works and put it together in the best way I can.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it's actually quite interesting, because I just recorded finished up an interview that will be released a few weeks before this one, so with Björn Gesman, and in my personal takeaways of that interview, I discussed exactly what you said about it not being very beneficial to be very attached to one strategy or tactic, even though from a branding perspective it can be, but from a coaching perspective probably not, because then you kind of put yourself in a small box with less options available. So yeah, being able to be flexible and change your mind are important characteristics in a coach, I feel.
For example, right now this zone to training is a big thing in social media, at least. And, you know, 10 years ago, high intensity training was a big deal in social media, right? So these things change a lot. The old stuff is the new stuff again. But I think it's super important not to just get carried away with all this hype and just try to stick to the stuff that works.
Yeah. I'll ask one of the questions that we have a bit later in our document now, because you mentioned avoiding or not doing things that don't work. So one of the questions I have is, what are the most common mistakes that you see age group athletes making that is maybe derailing their development? And maybe there are some, even though it's not the same for everybody, but some common denominators that you see in a lot of age groupers, or mistakes that they could avoid?
Well, there are a few things that I'm happy to talk about. One thing is that very often when you see a talented age grouper and he starts to work with a coach or join the triathlon club, everyone is super excited about him or her delivering the good results. And there is so much pressure on joining like the high performance side of the triathlon. Even for the people that just start training 1 or 2 years ago, if they show some good results, there is a lot of pressure, and a lot of coaches are like very happy to push them too hard too soon. So I think we lose a lot of talented athletes on the age group level, burning out or just not having fun doing triathlons way too soon. So that's one thing. And going too hard, too soon, too early, I think it's like one of the biggest mistakes. It's also associated with health, because usually you're not very good at listening to your body or knowing your body, knowing the patterns, how to avoid injuries and stuff like that if you just begin doing triathlon. So you are way more fragile and in this first period of training because you didn't learn your lessons yet. But yeah, probably this. And the other thing is that you should think about the long game, whether it's health-oriented or whether it's performance-oriented. And probably a good thing is to have a good support team that allows you to play the long game. It may be like people in the family, your friends, maybe a physiotherapist, maybe a coach. But I think it's super important to create your own environment as an age grouper that allows you to thrive, just to, you know, for the less competitive athletes that are enjoying the health benefits of doing triathlon. It may mean just telling your family how important is it to you that you feel good, that you feel like mentally well doing triathlons, that you feel healthy. And for the like more performance-oriented folk, you just probably might talk about your goals, what it takes to get them and stuff like that, and arrange all the support network around it. I think it's like a massive thing. And yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. And for those performance-oriented athletes, the ones that are racing for, well, maybe the first step is maybe trying to qualify for an Ironman World Championship or a 70.3 World Championship, and then eventually even maybe trying to fight for medals and victories, age group medals and age group victories, or even overall. Can you discuss a bit that higher performance age group level? What does it take to get there, both in terms of the athletic background experience and then also things like the lifestyle and of course the training and preparation? It's a broad question, but you can start in whichever end you want, and then we can dig deeper into some follow-up questions.
Well, if we talk about the age groupers qualifying for world championship, it obviously is different for everyone, especially after the pandemic, because, for example, it was relatively easy to qualify for Nice and relatively difficult to qualify for. It might be difficult to qualify for Kona this year because of these different locations and different qualification criteria. And for some, it will be very easy, and for some, will be very hard. And the same rule applies to the athlete's potential, which is not something that is probably discussed a lot, but some people need to do, like, let's say, achieve 80% of their physical potential to qualify, whereas the other people have to go like 100% because they're just on the edge. And obviously, I saw a lot of talented age groupers that don't work super hard, that train that don't train the crazy hours, they don't go through the very difficult and challenging training program, and they still achieve above average results, and they qualify to the international events without much problem. Whereas for other, they really have to do a lot of things right. Almost they there is no room for the mistakes to get it done. So it's very individual, and maybe frustrating for some if you just see your friend just, you know, doing less, having like a bad attitude and stuff like that, and still like outperforming you. So I think it's like super important to focus on yourself. Don't compare yourself to the other people. Compare to yourself yesterday and all these cliches, but I think it's like super important, because what you want to do is to stay in this ambitious preparation for a long time. When you discuss what it takes to qualify or what it takes to win, people very often discuss the hours of training and stuff like that. And for example, I can tell that my athletes that won in Kona, both male and age group, of course, both male and female, they did it on average for the last 6 months, they trained around 13 to 14 hours per week, which doesn't sound, it's not a lot, right? Compared to what you hear from other environments. But what distinguishes them is that they did it for many, many years. It's not that they started doing triathlon 3 or 4 years ago. They are in sport for like a decade or maybe longer, maybe slightly shorter, but it's a long period of time doing a smart work, doing a good work, staying healthy, improving from year to year, working on their weaknesses, learning how to win races, learning how to make decisions during the race, learning how to listen to your body and stuff like that. So I believe you shouldn't rush that. And then when you think about 14 hours, it's probably easier to accommodate in like regular lifestyle than this crazy 20, 25 hour training weeks. Of course, we also did some 20 hour training weeks, but it wasn't a rule. It was an exception. But generally speaking, you want to have a sustainable lifestyle where you can do the triathlon training for a long time and then you'll improve.
Yeah, I think this is a very common thing that it's always good to talk about training weeks because it's easy to overview and think about it like that. But then the problem with that is that when you hear about a 20-hour training week, then it doesn't tell the whole story of the decade that you had before that. So just some quick math in my head, 14 hours a week for, let's say, if you do that for 50 weeks of the year, that's 700 hours of training in a year. And if you do that for a decade, that's 7,000 hours of training.
Yeah. I just checked before our podcast, it was the 6 month average before the races, the Kona races. For the year, it was probably slightly less because there is usually a 3 week off season period when you just move, do not train and stuff like that. After the Ironman, you also like take some easier time. So if you qualify in the first race of the year to compete in the second race of the year, you also have like 10 days of like very little hours. And so it can be even less than this 700 hours per year.
But the point is that you can, if you train 20 hours a week for 8 weeks, you might feel like you're working so hard, like that is an immense effort to do 20 hours a week of training for 8 weeks before something like Kona. But then maybe if you're not training consistently and doing it for a long time, then still in terms of the overall like chronic workload that you're building, it might be a lot less than somebody who is training less in on paper per week, but they are just doing it quite consistently and they have done it for many years. So I think that's a good point about the athletic age of those athletes. And in terms of the how they use the time, the 6 months before training, I mean, obviously the training is individual, but are there any commonalities in the training of, let's say, for a very high level, high performing age grouper, something that is different than for a lot of more recreational age groupers?
I think the volume is just higher. Because even this 14 or 16 hours per week, it's way more than this 9 to 11 hours that a lot of people just train so that's the one thing. The other thing is we usually use the indoor cycling quite heavily because it's time efficient, especially in Poland. You know yourself probably from early years that the winter is difficult in these northern parts of the world. So you don't ride outside. It's dark very early, but in the same time it's very easy and efficient to train indoors. If you, for example, look at your cadence plot, for example, from the easy session outdoors and easy session indoors, even the very good athletes, when they, for example, spend 2 hours riding outdoors, they have like 15 minutes of cadence 0 to 5, power 0 to 15. So it's not like the continuous effort if you look really closely, whereas on the turbo trainer, every minute is maybe used as much as possible. So indoor training is one thing. The second thing is in terms of swimming, we just don't do much stuff except for the main sets, very short warm-up, Sometimes we just do a short preset, but if you are time crunched, we usually focus on some longer sets, build aerobic fitness in the water, because 4K during the race day is a lot when you think about Ironman, right? So if you have, for example, 3,500 meter session, usually the main set is around 3,000 meters. So there is a very lot of playing around the main set. It's just the main meal is there almost immediately. On the bike, except for this indoor cycling, we focus massively on the aerobic and anaerobic thresholds, which means kind of a lot of race pace as well. From the perspective of periodization, we use so-called reverse periodization. So we usually implement more intensive stuff in the early preparation, move towards more race-specific stuff. That means aerobic threshold and race pace-ish intensities closer to the most important races. When it comes to running, for the Ironman, we just try to build mileage, which for the top athletes means usually between on average 40 and 50K per week, which, to be honest, I think for a lot of people maybe not enough, but with my athletes, that's what I do, which it requires some context. Some of them are really good runners. Some of them run more in the winter, run some early season half marathons, and then may run slightly less in the triathlon season, but yeah, that will be like the overall program. It usually rounds up to around 15 hours per week when you think about this, like the last 6 months before the A race.
Yeah. Is the goal generally, are the athletes generally very well-rounded? So swimming, biking, and running, they are kind of similarly strong across the three disciplines, or can you achieve those big results with maybe having one discipline that is a bit weaker if you're really strong in another discipline, for example? What does that look like?
I mean, the general rule for the Polish athletes is most of them don't swim well, because for many years we didn't have access to the pools. The children weren't taught how to swim and stuff like that. So it's a typical case of an adult onset swimmer. So someone picks up triathlon at 40 years old and they learn how to swim technically, or at least they try. So we don't have much excellent swimmers here, but to qualify, you might have some weaknesses, right? To qualify for a world championship, but to win, even if you have, let's say, stronger sport, this weaker sport also have to be like very, very high level. So it may be like you are the first in your age group in running, but you're the second in cycling, not 20th in cycling, right? So obviously we adjust the training according to their needs, because I think it's super important to know the demands of the competition, know the level you want to be at, and simply adjust the training to that demands.
Yeah. Do you have any, what race strategies and what does race execution look like if you are an athlete fighting for actually being on the podium or winning your age group compared to just completing the race in a world championship event? Are there differences?
I think the longer the distance, the more the approach pace not race is valid, because in the Ironman you can't really do more than you are ready to do, and we know what you are ready to do before the race. So in Ironman races, it's just pace don't race and see what happens. Plus, at this very end, these races are often lonely. For example, if you race for, let's say, 9 hour 30 Ironman, there can be a big pack of athletes. So sometimes it's smarter to do 10 watts less and just sit 10 meters behind someone, just to know, fuel well, have some, you know, reality check. How do I feel? Did I eat well? Did I hydrate well? And stuff like that. But in the very front, you're on your own for the whole time. And sometimes you see athletes that are, for example, very good cyclists, but they're way better than you. And then they just go next to you, and you can't stick with them without sacrificing your run and stuff like that. So I think being confident is important, so you can do your own race, especially in the Ironman. In half Ironman, it's slightly different. There's more like race dynamics, especially in the younger categories. But overall, what I try to do with my athletes is, because if you are age grouper over 50, you can race you can race to your best with the decent age groupers that are, let's say, 30 years old. If you are a woman, you can race with men. But if you are a top age grouper that is 30 years old, well, you can only race with the pros to like achieve, like improve your level, to learn how to race, to be honest, because otherwise you just do your own race in like local races, regional races. And then once a year you go to the international, big international event, and it's totally different. So I usually try to find races where with the must start, when the top age groupers can race with the pros, like from the very on. So it also teaches them a lot. We have races like that in Poland, in your area, for example, Setubal next to Lisbon is this kind of race. When there is a must start, if you are a very competitive age grouper, it's like almost sure that you can race with some pros and learn from that. Because yeah, you have making somewhere, right? If you're just traveling and you're not pushed that much, you're not going to learn that. So always try to put them in this uncomfortable position to race with faster athletes and learn from that.
Yeah, that's good advice. And if especially for the Ironman, where it is pace, not race, what is the strategy for coming up with the pacing plan? Is it based on just specific workouts that will tell you where you are and what you should be able to do on race day, or do you have any other strategies?
It's exactly what you told us. Based on some very specific sessions, we decide what's accomplishable on the race day, and we just try to stick with that. We adjust nutrition. Of course, we do that also during these sessions. We adjust nutrition, hydration, pacing. The good thing about this specific sessions, it's also like a great place to check if your bike position is okay for the longer term, because you don't touch this type of fatigue in training that much as an age grouper. So these longer specific sessions allow you to master the nutrition, the hydration, the pacing, but also be confident about your bike positions, about your equipment, about, you know, all the solutions you plan to apply during the race day. So I think having some small amount, but longer, difficult race pace specific sessions before Ironman is super important.
Can you give an example of a preparation session for an Ironman that you would use?
I can give a good example of the training block. Imagine Saturday and Sunday. Saturday, you begin with a challenging swim, call it 4K. Then you go for a bike, not immediately, but in the same day, you go like 4 hours 30 to 5 hours with 2 by 90 minutes with Ironman race intensity. And during this 2 by 90 minutes, you stay in the aero position, you apply race-based nutrition and stuff like that. And that's Saturday. And for Sunday, you do a long break, for example, 3-hour bike plus 2-hour run. Not a race pace, just endurance pace, which is like slightly slower. And you also employ race-based nutrition. So it means you spend a lot of time on your foot, you spend a lot of time in the saddle, you know the position is sustainable in the long term. You know, well, it's not a cheap session in terms of race. I like nutrition because this stuff is kind of expensive. And if you even try to eat, let's say, 300 kilocalories per hour for like 10 hours total during 2 days, it's a lot, but it's the only way to check if it works on a race day. And hopefully, if you do 2 or 3 weekends like that, some of them will be super hot, some of them will be like different temperature, different conditions. So you can also check how do you feel and how do you perform in, you know, when it's super hot, when it's cold, how to adjust the equipment, if this jacket works, if this vest works, and stuff like that.
Yeah. With the run there, if the run is just endurance pace, how do you then decide on the race pace target from that? I mean, because I get the bike, because on Saturday you have the 2x90, yeah, so that should be a good indication of what you can do on race day. But with the run, how do you extrapolate that easier running to race pace running?
There is a bigger like context to that, because apart this Sunday run, they also do different sessions. But I think for most of the athletes, at Ironman pace in Kona, it's not that far away from an easy run. And if you are well trained and you start to run off the bikes, it's most of the athletes run slightly faster than they are going to run without the bike before, unless it's like super hard bike. So they already run slightly faster, let's say 10 to 15 seconds per day faster. And if they can keep going like that for 2 hours, I think that's very close to their Ironman race pace. And the good thing about the running race pace in Ironman is that you can adjust. Well, because there is no way to be 100% sure how are we going to feel after the bike, after the 20K of running and stuff like that. But it's not like swimming when you have just, it's very difficult to change your tactics during the swim. Whereas on the run, it's kind of easy to slow down, to pick up, to make, let's say, a 2 or 3K slower segment, catching up with nutrition, with hydration, lowering the body temperature, or, you know, employing some walking breaks and stuff like that. So you have a lot of cards in your hand. And if you touch this kind of fatigue in the sessions, you will be just smarter about applying them, because it's on the end of the day, it's the athlete's call, what are they going to do. Of course, we discuss all of these scenarios and stuff like that. But if you know, if we just, let's say we just decide it's good to run a 5 minute 15K per K for the Ironman, but the athlete after 10K knows it's not sustainable. He just slows down, right? And it's simple as that.
Yeah. And on the swim, can you give some more detail into what that simulation swim might look like?
It's not even a simulation swim. However, it's usually close to the race pace, or it's around the threshold. I usually think about having 3 to 3.5K or upper aerobic endurance work, which usually means Ironman pace to half Ironman pace with the segments between 100 and 300 meters. So you can just think about 300, 200, 100. That's 600 total. Five rounds of that, for example. It's just an example, right? Because I also try to keep it entertaining to the athletes, but overall, maybe three K and change around the race pace. It's something I try to achieve with these specific sessions.
And what is the so with the swim, because this is something that where I would often tell athletes to basically just swim endurance for even the faster athletes, because I feel like there's always a risk of going a little bit too hard and wasting a lot of extra energy for not very much return in terms of going faster. You might go 2 seconds faster per 100, so that's a minute and 16 seconds for the Ironman, but the actual intensity might be a lot harder for just those that 1 minute 16 seconds. So I tend to basically just say that to swim endurance pace for the Ironman. But but it sounds like maybe the pacing there is a bit harder or a bit more upper aerobic. Can you talk about the pacing and the relative intensity that you advise for the Ironman swim?
Well, it depends on the level of the athletes, right? Because if you have like people just wanting to finish, then surviving the swim is probably surviving the swim in a good shape is probably like the most important goal. Whereas when you race for some decent result, you probably have to push. The thing is that if you begin fast, you obviously can catch a good pack of swimmers or an appropriate pack of swimmers. And for the 4K, even if this pack breaks down in the middle, you already have like 2K swim with a nice group where you can save energy or just keep the momentum going, have a nice pace, have a nice rhythm and stuff like that. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think for slower athletes, it's very difficult to swim technically well if they swim slow. And for example, in training, if you think about aerobic session, let's call it 10 by 200 on 15 second recovery, it's not that they will swim it slightly faster than if you just tell them swim 2K straight without any breaks, right? They will swim it with slightly better technique because there is more focus, there is more place for deliberate practice. But when you think about 4K continuous swim, I think it's better to swim upper aerobic, non-lower aerobic, because simply the technique is better. If the athlete is swimming, for example, 2 minutes per 100, it's kind of impossible to swim at this speed with good technique, right? So I think going, for example, in this case, from 2 minutes per 100 to 1 minute 50 per 100 is already an improvement. In the same time, going from 1 minute 50 to 1 minute 42 is also an improvement in terms of the technique. I'm also not sure, and I really don't know. You have to ask someone else, because the faster you swim, you don't swim all out anyways, right? But the shorter the effort, the less energy expenditure, right? Of course, the intensity is higher, but I'm not sure how the calculation what's happening at the end, especially that in terms of muscle glycogen, it's very local. So when you just swim more on your arms rather than your legs, if you deplete your glycogen resources, it may be more local than global for this kind of effort, because it's roughly 1 hour and it's not an all-out effort anyways. So I'm not sure if just spending 10 or 15 minutes in the water, if it's if it's 16 seconds, it doesn't matter. But if it's 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it may matter, especially if the water is cold or stuff like that. But I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm thinking more about, for example, for the slightly faster athletes, let's say that they can swim 1:36 per 100 for the Ironman. So that's a 1 hour swim. And then the difference between 1:33 is maybe their, let's call it LT1, their upper aerobic that they could still do. And it's doable, but it's a bit more of an effort. So that's where I would maybe normally advise that, just swim your 1:36 because you're gaining very little, but you might actually fatigue yourself. But I'm not sure. Maybe the points that you're making there are actually something that makes sense for even also at that level. I definitely agree that if we're talking 10 minutes or even 5 minutes, then yeah, that's a big difference.
There's also a race dynamics, right? That the sooner you get out of the water, there is you're better placed on the bike course, right? Because if you're a cyclist, you don't have to go, you don't get stuck in the packs, you don't get stuck in the crowd, and the chance of catching other seriously prepared athletes that you can benefit without drafting or without doing anything illegal, but simply just riding, having them inside, having them 10, 15 meters in front of you, it's actually, there's a higher chance of having good athletes around you, and it helps.
Absolutely, yeah. Let me see here. Yeah, so if somebody right now is at a level where they can, they're good enough to qualify or at least fight for qualification for an event, for Ironman or 7.3 World Championships, but they're not at the point yet, but they want to get there. They want to get to the point of fighting for maybe getting to top 20, then top 10, then maybe event, maybe podium. What advice would you give them? This is a multi-year project, so not something for next year, but 5 years maybe.
Well, it's easy. Find a good coach, because it solves more of your problems that you're not even aware of. And I think there is a great value in good coaching. So that will be my number one advice, and I don't want to water it down, so we can just pause here. But generally, good coach, good environment, and patience.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. And then on a different side, so just going to the maybe more time-crunched age groupers, not necessarily world championship contenders or qualifiers, but do you have any general advice for how age groupers can get the most out of their training time? You already mentioned some, to be honest, with indoor training and mostly main sets in swimming. Is there anything else that we should talk about in terms of time crunched training?
Yeah, well, in some of my athletes, we just focus on two sports during the winter, in this early preparation phase. Most often it's that we don't do much swimming between December and February. So they just focus on bike and run, and they go to the pool like once every 2 weeks for a recovery session, because overall swimming can help in loosening the muscles. And I think there's a recovery value in swimming as well. But I saw that working very well in multiple times. It's not probably the most common approach, but you have like 6 or 8 hours per week to train and you share it among 3 sports, it's very difficult to improve if any of these sports. You can probably maintain that or improve at the very early phase when it's easy to improve. But later, 2 swims, 2 runs, 2 bikes per week, it's like if you have performance goals, not health goals, it's not enough. So trying to balance it out, because it's always easier to maintain the level of fitness, not acquire the new level of fitness. So once you acquire the new level of fitness with training only 2 sports, you can maintain it relatively easier. So yeah, that would be my advice, that maybe 3 months of the year, just focus on the 2 sports and try to catch up later. I also think that you can't take many shortcuts in running. there is no way to, unless you're super talented, but it's not up to you. You have to run your mileage. You shouldn't really try to cut corners with high intensity stuff because the injury risk is very high. So there is no good answer when it comes to running, but on the bike you can probably try to cover lack of the volume with slightly higher intensity. It's relatively safe. I saw it works many times. Obviously the question is if with this kind of very intensive program you can spend years in triathlon, but it's something we discussed slightly before, that if you want to spend years in triathlon, which is good for the performance, shouldn't really go redlining too much.
No, those are great tips. And looking at each discipline specifically, if you can give some additional advice around the overall training planning or programming that might help the listeners, can you give, let's start with swimming, two additional tips for listeners to help improve their swimming performance?
Well, first, find a good coach, and two, swim more. What I see with the age groupers, they just swim like 4K per week or 5K per week, and they're surprised that not improving. It's not enough.
Yeah. And cycling.
Get a good bike fit and train specific to the race demands.
And finally, running.
Play the long game. Don't cut corners with high intensity and use hills a lot.
Yeah, that's a good one. Oh, and actually, I said finally running, but this is the final one. So two tips to improve the overall training structure or training programming.
Well, I will say find a good coach or a support network, and also try to stay healthy and enjoy the sport as long as you can without like going too deep.
And finally, to finish off the first part of this interview about coaching, some reflective questions. Is there something that you're trying to learn more about at the moment or focus on at the moment or recently?
Not that much, to be honest. I just try to show up and do as good work as possible. But at this part of the season, because we're recording it like February/March, talk with my athletes a lot about nutrition, because with this reverse periodization approach, it's the time when they start to train more volume. The rides are getting longer, the runs are getting longer, and every year I have to remind them how crucial nutrition is. What does it mean to fuel well, to hydrate well, just to build good habits for the months to come? So definitely a lot of the talks I have with the athletes right now are about nutrition, and yeah, that's it.
That actually made me remember one follow-up question I had about the race pace and race execution part that we discussed before, is what nutrition and hydration in an Ironman, especially, let's use that as an example. What do you have general advice there? Do you use 90 grams an hour of carbs as a good general advice, or do you advise people, especially let's say high performing age groupers, to go even higher to 100 plus grams an hour? Any tips on that side?
Well, 90 grams per hour of carbohydrates is a good starting point. However, I saw many even age group athletes that can eat and use more. One thing to do that is gut training, and this is the thing I try to implement with all of the athletes, which is very close to simply practicing the race day nutrition during the longer sessions. But yeah, it's also trainable. How much energy you can consume and you can actually deliver to the working muscles is a trainable thing. Maybe the science isn't there yet, however it's emerging, but everyone interested in the topic of gut training and just... And this specific long-distance nutrition can probably find some valuable resources right now. And I think it's super important for not only for the performance, but also for recovery and adaptation. So it cannot be overstated.
Yeah. And then going back to the reflective coaching questions, if you could go back in time to earlier in your coaching career and give yourself some advice, what would you tell yourself?
You know, I was wearing different hats with my triathlon coaching career, from age group to like professional triathlon. So in terms of professional triathlon, one thing will be not to compromise on high performance standards. because it's also associated with the question you asked about the Polish triathlon, the state of the Polish triathlon. I think it was too easy to me to just compromise on the things that I shouldn't compromise on. And probably in the early phase, I should focus more on the basics, on the fundamentals and stuff like that, rather than making things interesting or just wishful think and daydream about what may happen next year. So I'm definitely more grounded now, and I'm applying more less interesting and less sexy and less exciting stuff, and just focus more on the base work that actually I think can benefit almost all the athletes independent of the training level.
And would the answer be different for age groupers then, or is that also the general answer to the question?
It also applies for the age group coaching in terms of like not getting too excited about the newest stuff, about high intensity stuff and all these things. But for the age groupers, I would think I put more emphasis now on creating a right environment at their side, at home, with the family, at the job, just making them aware of the if you know what it takes to be successful in triathlon, then you can plan accordingly all the other areas of life. And obviously, it may come with some sacrifices, and I'm okay with the athletes doing these sacrifices, the age group athletes doing these sacrifices at home or at work, but it must be their conscious decision. So I do a lot of work just making sure they understand the assignment and understand the cost, because, you know, it's very difficult, almost, I think it's possible to be very good at three things, like work, family, and sport. Two things are achievable. Three things, but maybe you don't need to be balanced for the whole life, right? But it should be a conscious decision what you focus on and what are the costs. And with these more ambitious athletes, I try to make them acknowledging that, right?
Great answer. Now, let's get into the second part where we will discuss respiratory physiology and respiratory training. So this is an area that you have been researching as part of your academic profession. So can you just give an overview, maybe first of all, give an overview of your own academic focus? Where are you at academically at the moment, and what are the things that you have been investigating and are investigating? And then we get into some specifics.
Well, I'm not a distinguished academic, because as I said before, it's just under 2 years when it comes to the research experience. But one of my main areas of the focus is respiratory muscle training and respiratory training, which is a way to improve respiratory fitness, and it may be also useful to the athletes. However, it wasn't really recognized that much during the years, because in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the literature claim that this respiratory fitness isn't very important or isn't necessary to improve VO2 max, because at that time VO2 max was associated with the level of athletic performance. Right now we know it's just a number. There is more to the athletic performance than only VO2 max. But for many years, this was the reason, this lack of connection between respiratory fitness and VO2 max, that led to diminishing interest of exercise physiologists in respiratory system. However, for about 20 years, there is an interesting research going on, and we are smarter than we used to be, and we know it may be useful even for very well-trained athletes.
So let's start with, how can it be useful if it's not for VO2 max?
Oh, it's a very, it's very best question, but obviously we should start with that VO2 max is not the same as the performance in triathlon. So if something is not beneficial to VO2 max, it doesn't mean it's not beneficial to the performance. Because there are a lot of performance determinants in endurance sports. VO2 max is traditionally one of them, mostly because it was very easy to measure that, and there is a good correlation. But the main source of benefits coming from respiratory muscle training is attenuating or mitigating something called respiratory metabolic reflex. Basically, this phenomenon is based on that the respiratory muscles, especially the diaphragm, are super important to the brain. And when they start to get fatigued, the blood flow is redirected from the working limbs, for example, legs during cycling, to respiratory muscles, so the respiratory function must be maintained. But what happens with the legs? The fatigue is growing up faster, is building up faster. I can't really tell what year this respiratory motor reflex was described and discovered. But obviously, when you just look at respiratory muscles in isolation, there isn't many exciting things happening there. But when you look at the whole system and this blood flow moving from the working limbs to respiratory muscles, you see that this limitation become more apparent at the muscular level and that impairs performance. And with respiratory muscle training, we can postpone the time when this respiratory metabolic reflex kicks in.
Mm, yeah, no, that's interesting. So in theory, at least, then we should... respiratory, it also makes some sense maybe why earlier studies couldn't find benefits, because if you do very short tests, maybe you don't have time to induce fatigue in the respiratory system, but maybe in something like an Ironman, you really induce that fatigue and that contributes then to the metabolic reflex kicking in a later stage of the bike, for example.
Yeah, that's very true. In this traditional laboratory test, you cannot see respiratory muscle fatigue because it requires efforts either very long or above 85% of VO2 max and taking more than half an hour. So if you think about Olympic distance race, half Ironman distance race or Ironman racing, there is respiratory muscle fatigue. But when you think about 20-minute or 15-minute VO2 max testing, it's impossible to spot the respiratory fatigue and therefore to assess the function of respiratory muscles, their strength and endurance.
Yeah. So let's...
It's not the only aspect. It also, in many athletes, it also helps with simple ventilation and the breathing. There is also a thing about vagal nerve stimulation that can enhance the recovery in depending on the training protocol. And what you can see that with less trained athletes or the elderly people or the patients, the respiratory muscle training also improves all the endurance aspects. Whereas with this, the better trained you are, these overall effects diminish. However, this attenuating the metabolic reflex effect is still valid. So there is big rationale to use that with in general population. And there is smaller but still very relevant rationale to use that in the highly trained population.
Right. Yeah. So let's discuss the different methods, because there are a few different methods of respiratory muscle training. Can you give an overview of them?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, we can divide this respiratory muscle training into two groups: more strength endurance or more strength oriented and more endurance oriented. Strength-oriented are techniques like intrapressure threshold loading or tapered flow, and you can use the trainers like Aerofit or Power Breath. The protocols are usually based on a smaller amount of respiratory maneuvers, so the session can take like 2 minutes, but you just have to fight with the resistance of this respiratory trainer. Usually it's about inspiration rather than expiration, because the inspiration is more like a conscious one, whereas expiration is simple, just relaxation, and you just exhale the air like automatically. And this endurance method, for example, voluntary isocapnic hypopnea, when you also use different kind of trainers like isocapnic Berkeley Better or Spyro Tiger, is more endurance based. So the session takes between 15 to even 30 minutes. Surprisingly, both elicit kind of similar effects. Maybe with the testing, these effects are slightly different, but when you look at the performance, the effects of both methods are very, very similar. So when you think about choosing the appropriate method for you, you can actually use the one you like more and you will be fine.
Yeah. In terms of when you say that they induce similar effects, is that in terms of the maybe direct respiratory measures like spirometry, or is it actually in terms of performance as well? Has that been tested both and compared?
Actually, we talked about performance here, but in terms of respiratory measurements, they also elicit kind of less similar than in the performance, but the direction is more or less the same. You usually do not measure respiratory muscle strength or endurance with like traditional spirometry. There are some accessory tests to that, like maximum inspiratory pressure. The test that I actually like a lot, which is S-index, strength index test designed by Power Breath, which is a dynamic assessment. So it's slightly more appropriate for sports because like maximum inspiratory pressure, it's more static. So you don't really see what's happening during like the whole respiratory maneuver. Yeah, we can actually, I can say a few more words about this S-index testing because spirometry is like a medical examination and performing spirometry is restricted to the health professionals in, I think, almost most of the countries. So for the coaches of the athletes, doing spirometry on their own, even with these very easy mobile devices, well, isn't encouraged. But with this Power Breath S-index test that you simply use your Power Breath device, a coach can use that with the athletes without any formal restrictions. It's also mobile, and I think it's slightly more appropriate for this athletic population.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What sorts of protocols then are we talking about when it comes to improving performance? How often do you need to do respiratory muscle training, and for how long does it take to start seeing effects?
It's one of the training formats that you can see the effects extremely soon, and they're extremely big. I cannot think about any other training that can elicit such big results as so soon, because 4 to 6 weeks can actually help to improve your, for example, S-index test between 20% and 40%, which is kind of massively, right? There aren't a lot of trainings formats or training aspects where you can improve like with this range in 1 month time. So actually you can see a big benefit in 4 to 6 weeks of this type of training. And when it comes to protocols, this strength oriented training, the typical protocol is twice a day, 5 days a week, 30 inspiratory maneuvers. So that's maybe under 5 minutes total per day. You can do it like, you know, in the car or in the office, because one session, this 30 respiratory maneuvers is 1 minute 30 to 2 minutes. And you don't get sweaty or anything like that. But overall, it's like 10 sessions across the week. Whereas this endurance method, you usually train 2 to 4 times per week or every other day. And the session takes between 10 and 30 minutes long. So yeah, it can, well, it depends on the schedule. The effects are similar. And usually the athletes I work with, they can just choose what they feel like doing more, and I'm not really strict about that.
Yeah, but do you see a trend? Because I imagine that the strength method has slightly less, it's slightly easier to implement just because the protocol is so short every time you do it. Of course, you need to, I guess, be very consistent with it, but still the overall time demands are a bit lower, so it might be easier to implement when you're already, yeah, you already have a busy schedule.
Yeah, I see this pattern, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Can we talk about the costs of the devices, both for the strength method and endurance method? Are there differences there?
I can be wrong here, but more or less, in terms of US dollars, I think the cheapest devices, mechanical devices from the strength-oriented protocols are about $60 to $80. The more advanced electronical ones are about $600 to $800, whereas devices from the endurance protocols like Isokapnik, I don't know, they can be $100, $50 maybe, stuff like that. And all of these are very good equipment, and I can totally recommend all the brands I've mentioned before. I'm not attached to many of them, so yeah.
Yeah. And so what about the level of athlete? So in terms of, let's say, just general population we talked about a bit, but age group triathletes that are already very fit versus top level age group triathletes versus professional triathletes, do you see that all of these different levels could benefit from doing respiratory muscle training, or is there a population or like, let's say, fitness level effect there that you should consider?
I think all these populations can benefit from respiratory muscle training. There are some individual differences. For example, usually women may benefit more compared to men. And athletes with any kind of respiratory diseases or lung diseases, obstructive or restrictive, for example, asthma, it's not a contradiction. It's actually, it can be like super helpful in with this population. And obviously, a lot of athletes have this kind of respiratory issues. Finally, there is a good evidence base about improvement in altitude, meaning both during efforts in the altitude and as a preparation before coming to the altitude camps. The adaptation takes shorter time. The ventilation system is not that overwhelmed once you get to the altitude. So at least these aspects are the one that pop just have right now for you.
That's really interesting.
Obviously, the best way is to do some testing. For example, this S-index test from Power Breath. And if you are a woman and your result is under 100 centimeters of water volume, because that's the unit in English probably, you will benefit from respiratory muscle training. If you are a male and you are under 140, that's also, for me, it's a signal that you should benefit more. But for example, if you're a woman and you are already, your result is already around 150, and you are a man and your result is already about 200, I think there is like there is no much motivation or rationale to implement that, because if it's your weakness, you should work on that. If you're already well taken care of there, there is no reason to add extra work and extra load on you.
Mm. And if you are somebody that could benefit, let's say using the S index test, then what do we know about how the improvements translate in terms of the magnitude of the effects that it can have on your endurance performance? What do we know about that?
As usual, there is some mixed reporting, but the general rule is the longer the effort, the bigger the advantage is, the bigger the improvement is. So for Ironman or half Ironman, it should be more substantial than, for example, for a 3-kilometer race. But in terms of percentage, I can't give you certain numbers. There is not much research on triathletes. However, there's like a good rationale. For example, when you swim with a wetsuit, your chest is kind of restricted with the neoprene. So when you have to find the resistance of the neoprene, your respiratory muscle fatigue faster. When you bike in the time trial position, your chest is also restricted, and the respiratory muscle also have to cover the to overcome the extra resistance. So there is a good rationale that even looking what happens in swimming, which is causing a lot of respiratory fatigue, and looking at the research on cyclists, you can see the good reason why it should work well in triathlon.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you talked about how you can see the results within a short time frame, 6 to 8 weeks. But what about, is this something that deteriorates quickly as well? So do you basically need to do this consistently throughout the year, or do you do it for the 6 to 8 weeks leading into your key race? How would you implement it practically into the periodization?
Yeah, I usually go with 6 to 8 weeks of like dedicated training, and then just go to the maintenance mode, which means 1 to 3 sessions per week. Because once you achieve this high level of respiratory fitness, it's very easy to maintain it. Even without respiratory muscle training, the regular activities allow you to maintain it to a certain extent. But maybe we should also mention that only the training swim, bike, run isn't enough to stimulate the respiratory muscles. That's why the respiratory muscle training was invented and implemented. Because even if you train hard, swim, bike, run, the stimulus is not there to improve the function of respiratory muscles. It requires dedicated training. But to maintain, very often that's enough.
That's fascinating. Let me see. Is there anything else in terms of practical implementation that you can think of that for, let's say, somebody is now interested in implementing this? Any other tips other than what you already mentioned that you would like to share?
Well, probably it's not the most exciting type of training, and you can see people enjoying cycling outside or running in the sun or in the snow, but you don't meet many people getting excited about respiratory muscle training. So it's very important to have these benefits in mind to keep the motivation going, to see the why behind the training. I will also encourage everyone to use any kind of habit building ideas, like, you know, putting X on your calendar once you do a respiratory muscle training session, or employ it in your training peak so you can then just mark your training sessions green or stuff like that, because you need a lot of internal motivation to keep going. It's really not exciting. It's like, you know, stretching maybe, or even worse. The other thing is, if you have any negative symptoms like strong headaches or dizziness, there's like a decent list of contradictions of people that shouldn't really, of people, for example, after strokes, and there are certain medical conditions that should be very careful with respiratory muscle training. But when you buy any kind of this device, you will get a manual, or you can just find it online. But just if somehow it's very hard for you, for example, you get very dizzy, you have headaches, you feel your like blood pressure jumps, well, just stop doing that. Yeah. Safety is like the number one thing here. And
I can vouch for what you said about it not being very excited, because I did at one point start doing this training, and I managed a week and then I stopped. So I probably should have used some of the habit forming tips to maintain more to be able to continue doing that. I will say I did find it more fun than stretching, so it's not that terrible. Okay. I think that those are great points. And then finally, I guess, in terms of the academic side of things, do you have any, what is the research that you think should be done next in this field? Are you working on any of this research that you want to share what you're working on? And just in general as well, what are some future studies that you think should be done within this field?
Well, I can't tell you everything, but what we are already finished the research and now just writing the articles and trying to publish is the next step, is employing this endurance respiratory muscle training as a recovery tool, because it engages the diaphragm a lot, and diaphragm is maybe the only muscle in the whole body that is a net lactate consumer, so it kind of drains the lactate from the bloodstream. In the same time, it stimulates this respiratory muscle training, like voluntary isocapnic hyperpnea. It stimulates the vagal nerve. So there is a good rationale that it can be used in recovery. We did some studies with short track speed skaters who have multiple races across the day, sometimes with very short break between the races. So they cannot employ traditional active recovery protocols like cycling or, I know, even massage, because they need a certain muscle tension. So we're exploring with some interesting results the recovery effect of these endurance respiratory muscle protocols, and I think it's promising. So that is one thing. The other thing is more about respiratory training, not respiratory muscle training, but it's about how the breathing protocols or breathing patterns can help with managing the stress around racing and anxiety around racing and stuff like that. There is a big research on that from the psychological perspective, because like breathing was used for many years as a tool to cope with anxiety and manage stress, but applying in a sport context is also something we are thinking about.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, I think that what would also be really interesting is just to see some of what we talked about already, that if the longer the effort, the more important it might be, then that would be interesting to try to quantify what is the impact of respiratory muscle training on long efforts.
Actually, it was already quantified. I don't remember the exact number, but I think on this classic laboratory testing, which can take like 20 minutes, the effect was 1.6% higher with every minute of the test. So I don't think we should extrapolate that to 10 hours of racing, but I mean, there is some evidence already there.
1.6% higher for, can you clarify that?
I'm not sure, because I don't have this paper, like I didn't read it recently, but I'm sure it's there. We can definitely link the paper in the show notes.
We'll do
but
that.
But I think the positive effect of respiratory muscle training was 1.6% better, higher with every minute of the test. So if obviously it's compared to the base. So there's a basic effect, and this effect was better the longer the duration of the test. But it's not that everyone was better 1.6% or stuff like that. It's just the positive effect of respiratory muscle training was bigger the longer the effort.
Then let's finish with some listener questions. So the first one that I have here is from Henry, who asks thoughts on nose breathing during threshold work.
I'm not a fan, to be honest. Obviously the reports are mixed, and there are a lot of believers or people that are super attached to the idea that nose breathing is like the cure for all the problems in the world. I generally encourage my athletes to apply nose breathing on an everyday basis. Like, it's the best way to breathe, but not necessarily during the exercise. I don't see much value in nose breathing during the threshold session because it will make it harder for the body. And I'm usually a fan of having the training sessions as easy as possible. If you can deliver the intensity, if you can deliver the work without getting too fatigued, without going too deep, that's a good thing for me. I see no point in making it more difficult, and I'm not aware of any performance benefits right there.
Yeah, and you might not even be able to do the session with the same power or pace.
Probably, yeah. You have crazy struggle, right, in most of the cases. Yeah.
The second question is from Joao, who is asking, for athletes struggling with exercise-induced asthma during hard efforts, but no asthma diagnosis, any advice?
Well, definitely respiratory muscle training helps in asthma, but the biggest advice is just consult with a doctor. And it's like with coaching, there are probably good doctors and bad doctors. There are doctors that specialize in the athletes and are more aware of exercise-induced asthma. But yeah, I think we shouldn't just like give freely the medical advice without appropriate disclaimers, knowing the issues and stuff like that, and consulting with the doctor is like the best advice I have here.
Yeah, no, great. And finally, the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer these. And then a surprise question that I forgot to send you. I didn't mean to ignore it, but I just recently came up with it. But I think you will be a good person to ask that one. But let's start with the general ones, or the ones that you already know. What's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
I think one resource would be Endure by Alex Hutchinson, but I also had a long period of consuming all the podcasts, including yours, and I think there is a lot of interesting stuff out there.
And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Probably having a strong border between professional and stronger, not very strong, but stronger border between professional and private life, being able to turn off after, let's say, 8 o'clock in the evening and just have a good separation between all these communication channels and real life on an everyday basis.
Mm. And finally, who's somebody do you look up to or that has inspired you?
Actually, it's such a long list that it's hard to tell, but I don't have like one big idol. I just try to learn from as many people, as many successful people as possible. No names here, but I just try to digest as much knowledge as possible from the people that are successful and you know, compile that and learn, apply in the setting that I have.
Yeah, fair enough. And then the surprise question. So I started this in a recent interview with Björn Gesman. So the question is to pick your podium, men's and women's podium for the Paris Olympics, the individual triathlon races. And I'm going to compile a spreadsheet with all the guests and their guesses. And then after the Olympics, you can see who guessed the best.
Oh, I think I will pass.
You'll pass? Okay.
Now that I'm involved with some of the athletes.
Yeah.
And well, yeah, I can. Yeah. So I think it's, I have my types, of course. Maybe the record.
Yeah. All right. Great. And finally, where can listeners follow you and find your work?
I have an Instagram account, kowalski.coach, and that's probably the best way. if someone is more interested in science, then I can we can link the ResearchGate profile when there is some there's always yeah. a new studies that I publish and I recommend.
Yeah. All right. Perfect. Thank you, Tomek. It was great to catch up and have a good continued training camp in Montegordo.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here. Bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with the relevant links mentioned, including, of course, Tomek's social media, ResearchGate, and coaching business website. I have two papers linked there. One of them we discussed and one of them we didn't discuss specifically, but it gives you a great overview of the evidence base behind various respiratory muscle training or respiratory training in general interventions. So for those that want to dig deeper, there's two good studies, systematic reviews that you can go and have a look at through the show notes or the links in the episode descriptions. So a few personal takeaways that I had, and by the way, I do want to clarify a little bit how I construct these personal takeaways. Basically, it's just whatever pops into my head from the interview, and sometimes it is summarizing what was said, what the guest said in the interview, or some other times it might be me linking what was said to some slightly different tangential topic. I'm using these very liberally and really just using them to reflect on what I got from the interview in some ways, but also hopefully this can be very useful for all the listeners. But the first one is around how the training age or training experience of an athlete is probably more important for great performances at the world championship level races than big training weeks for the block of, let's say, 3 or 4 months leading into the race. So that's something that speaks to the importance of consistency over years and years and patience over years and years. If you want to achieve your best triathlon or endurance sports results, nothing new, nothing revolutionary, but it's always useful to hear those sorts of things, I think, and get a reminder of them. So training age, training experience, consistency over years, make those focus points if you want to really get to your best level. The second point that I wrote down is that even for an age grouper, the importance of your team, your environment, and quality coaching, and how much that matters. And in terms of the team specifically, I want to narrow in on that one. In the context of an age group triathlete, we're not talking the kind of teams that a professional athlete has, of course, but the team that you do have might include some experts that you turn to in specific questions or challenges. So, for example, a physiotherapist to help deal with any niggles or injuries that you might have. And also, of course, training partners and coaches would fall into the category of your team. But in my experience, the most important part of your team is your family. In the athletes that I've coached, I've seen a big difference in long-term consistency and progression based on how supportive the family or the significant other of an athlete is and how supportive they are of the athlete's goals within the sport. So this is not to say that that you should go and complain that your family is holding you back. Absolutely not. I think it is a question of communication, but also about how you give back in other ways. So if you want to have buy-in and support from your family or your significant other, firstly, you need to communicate clearly why the sport matters to you and your goals matter to you so much. Why do you invest so much in the sport? So it starts with great communication. But I also think that in most cases, unless you have a way of giving back with supporting the family in other ways, in their goals, in their pursuits, then it's probably not going to, you're not going to get that the level of support that you need back. So I think that this is something to think about, and every situation is unique. There's no one way necessarily, but I think that the knowledge that the family is probably the most important aspect of your team as an age group triathlete, that's very important to have. And finding ways that you can make that part of your team, the core team, really be supportive of your goals and your pursuits, that's going to set you up to have better results over the long term than almost anything else that you can do. And then the final personal takeaway is around respiratory muscle training. So the evidence here, as Tomek laid out, seems to be pretty clear towards beneficial effects for endurance performance, especially as durations get longer. And again, refer to that first systematic review and meta-analysis linked to in the show notes and episode description for more details on that. From a practical perspective, the strength type of respiratory muscle training, so which is called, technically speaking, inspiratory pressure threshold loading, IPTL, that might be a bit easier for most people to implement as the training protocols are much shorter than the endurance type of RMT, the endurance type being voluntary isocapnic hyperpnea, but either type could work, and I've seen people use the VIH in conjunction with endurance training, so for example while riding on the indoor trainer or between reps in the pool. This does require more careful consideration in how to really combine that type of RMT within the endurance training without compromising the training quality, but it could be a time-efficient way to include it. I have to say that personally, I have extremely limited personal experience, and including coaching experience and personal athletic experience with it, with respiratory muscle training. So I don't really have much to contribute with, but I do think that in terms of the evidence, there does seem to be potential here. But for athletes that are already doing all the basic things pretty well, so in this sense, I think it's similar to weight training. If your main goal is to perform in triathlon, you have to make sure that you get the basics of triathlon training right, including swim, bike, run, sleep, and nutrition. And then it might start to make sense to implement things like weight training or respiratory muscle training. But when you are at that point, when you do those basic things well, if you found the information that Tomek shared here intriguing, then do give it a try and see how it goes. I don't think there is much to lose, especially since, as Tomek shared, it does seem to result in these responses that you might get relatively quickly, and then you can go into maintenance mode, basically. So yeah, very interesting stuff. Definitely something that I want to dig deeper into and experiment with in a bit more detail. Just a couple of quick things before we end this episode. As I said in the last episode, I've heard that podcast algorithms are now really valuing recent reviews again in how they rank and show podcasts in the search feed. So please, if you like this podcast, it would mean a lot if you could rate and review it, especially in Apple Podcasts and Spotify, which are the two main platforms where people find and listen to the podcast. So that would be huge if you could do that. I would really appreciate that. Secondly, if you need any help with your training, if you want coaching, consultations, training plans, and so on, check out all we have to offer on scientifictriathlon.com. I want to read a recent review that came in via our training plan feedback form. This one is from Nathan, who used the advanced half distance training plan, and he rated it 10 out of 10. Some excerpts of what he wrote in the questions in the feedback form include, I purchased a plan to have structure and intelligent design in my training, to do purposeful training that would result in increased fitness and better race performance. The plan had really good organization, clear instructions as to the structure and purpose of each workout, and it makes it much easier to train consistently. This was the highest volume that I've ever consistently trained at. One of the most positive changes I noticed was how quickly I was able to recover, and the end result was that I improved my time in an Ironman 7.3 by half an hour. So that's a huge result. Nathan, congratulations. Really happy that the training plan worked so well for you. And for any listener that want to improve training and performance levels but can't afford coaching, which is a big investment and understandably not something that's possible for everybody, I think that ready-made training plans are a fantastic option because it gives you structure. They are proven with many, many athletes that in general the structure works really well, and they work even better when you combine it with the knowledge that you gain through listening to that triathlon show. Then you can use the plan as a starting point but tweak it to suit your individual needs based on the knowledge that you already have as a podcast listener. Check that out and email me if you have any questions or want to inquire about things like coaching, consultations, and so on. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find at precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.